This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For many, reading Tolstoy's War and Peace sounds like a lifetime achievement, like running a marathon or climbing Mount McKinley. But once you start, it's hard to stop. And every generation seems to issue a new 1,200-page challenge to bring a new translation of the great story of battle and love, the beautiful Natasha, the searching Pierre, St. Petersburg's drawing rooms, and Moscow burning in Napoleon's wake. Now comes a marvelous new translation from a famous husband and wife partnership, known these days as the A-Team of Russian to English translators. And we're in an era of our own war and longing for peace. It's a good time to read Tolstoy afresh. This hour on Point, War and Peace, comes again. You can join the conversation. Have you been swept away by this great Russian epic? Are you ready to dive in again or join the fray for the first time? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio are Richard Pevere and Larissa Volohonsky, the husband and wife team that has now translated 15 major Russian works to English. Richard is a poet who hails from Boston originally. Larissa, a translator born in Leningrad. They work together these days in their Paris apartment, translating the great works of Dostoevsky, Chekhov, Gogol, and, of course, Tolstoy. Their version of Anna Karenina hit the bestseller list in 2004 after Oprah's book club made it a top pick. Now Richard and Larissa, or P&V as fans and scholars now know them, have translated War and Peace. It's 1,215 pages of hard, beautiful work. It came out yesterday. Richard and Larissa, congratulations and welcome. A great day for you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's out. It's on the shelves. Marvelous.
It's on and leaving.
Yeah, right. Just terrific. I so look forward to diving into this hour, and it's been such a pleasure to get to pick this book up again after so very many years and really be swept away by it. Richard Pevere, for those who have and for those who haven't, remind us, just broad stroke if you would, what was the world that Leo Tolstoy was portraying, conveying in War and Peace?
It was the world of the Russian aristocracy, mainly of Petersburg and Moscow, in the period of the Napoleonic Wars. First, 1905, when the Russians belonged to the...
1805,
I mean, 1805, yeah. Right, when the Russians belonged to the coalition that was opposing the French, and then in 1812, when the French invaded Russia, when Napoleon brought 500,000 troops into Russia, which was a crisis and a re-self-definition for the Russian national spirit. And this is how Tolstoy understood it. He explains that this war of 1812 for Russia was not a military war, it was a national war. And the Russian national spirit reawakened, or awakened after that. And the whole novel is saturated with details of that period. Tolstoy had an incredibly strong and rich memory and a very good eye for detail. And so he brings this to life in a way that is still fresh, still very alive, still very real.
Of course, it's more than memory. It has to be imagination, because he's writing it in the 1860s. He wasn't alive during that time, and yet He drew on those around him for the famous characters and characterizations. We'll look at how he came to write it. But the question for many is how they come to read it. Larissa Volohonsky, you grew up in Soviet Union, in Russia. When did you first read this book, and what did it mean to you?
Well, I first read it very early. But I must say that I was not a precocious child, but simply I began to read very early, and I read War and Peace for the first time when I was 13. And I must confess that I did not read the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
I was mostly interested in Natasha's life.
Yes.
Because at the beginning of the novel, Natasha is 13.
She's your age. She's so lively and bright and irresistible.
And she's in love for the first time.
Right.
Or, as one philologist said, she is in love with being in love.
Yeah. And it's, as 13-year-olds can be.
Yes. And so I followed Natasha's story and all, and generally all the parts concerned with more than with peace than with war.
The peace, the parlor, all the interpersonal relations, which are so rich and deep and nuanced in this book.
Yes, it's incredible. Tolstoy portrays all kinds of life. You find everything in this novel. But later in my life, I reread the novel several times, mm-hmm. and each time you reread it, you discover new things, new depths, new heights, new breadths.
It's a bell ringer.
new things that you never noticed before.
Mm-hmm.
And as you grow older and older, you find more and more wisdom in it. I even want to tell a story about, I knew an old lady.
Please, yeah.
Very old lady, mm-hmm. who claimed that she reread War and Peace every year of her life.
And did nothing else then, perhaps.
Because she thought that it was so full of wisdom that one has to just draw from it.
Wow.
continually.
That would be a consuming passion to read this one every year. Richard Prevere, what was Tolstoy setting out to do here? He said this isn't a novel, and he didn't want exactly to write history. And yet he had a very deliberate intention in mind.
He had an intention in mind, and you're very right to say that he resisted the idea of a novel. He insisted that his book was not a novel and was not a history. It was not an epic. All three words are very often applied to
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm. But it's hard to know what else to...
But that's the beauty of Tolstoy is he never says what it is.
Yes.
He only says what it isn't.
Yes.
And later he wrote a little essay on War and Peace. He said that historians draw from primary materials, from sources, from written documents, statements by generals or by politicians. All of this, he said, is of no use to the artist. But he never says what is of use to the artist. He avoided formulating. He was an extremely experimental writer, especially in this novel. But he began that way. His first written work was called The History of Yesterday. And it was unfinished, but he attempted to write the story of everything that happened in one day. He said that there was so much that he couldn't write it. But
not to fashion it exactly, not to mold it or
exactly,
interpret it, but simply to convey it.
Not to make a story, not to give a point of moral, not to teach something, but simply to capture what happens. This is what was his passion, and this occurs again in his stories about his military actions in the Crimean War, the Sevastopol stories,
mm-hmm.
and then finally in War and Peace, his fullest development of this attempt to somehow surround and contain happening as it happens in all its detail and all its reality.
He began with the goal of conveying the world of the Decembrists, the sort of reform-minded aristocrats who wanted to bring constitutional monarchy after the death of Alexander I in 1825, and then worked backward into this whole age of glory and Bonaparte.
Yes, he was. In fact, he was going to tell about a Decembrist who went to Siberia and was pardoned by Alexander II. So he was mm-hmm. he was almost contemporary with himself. And then he worked backwards from 1856 to 1825, from 1825 to 1812, and then finally to 1805, and that's where he began the novel.
And there we have War and Peace. Mm-hmm. He wrote it, Larissa, while Americans were in the midst of their Civil War. I mean, it's nearly a century and a half ago now. He was a young man, 35.
When he began, he was 35.
All right. But even having been written in the 1860s, at least in your translation, it sounds not exactly like spoken everyday English, but quite modern. Is that inherent in the Russian itself?
Well, we have to decide what is modern.
Yes.
You just said new generations come and new mm-hmm. translations mm-hmm. come. Mm-hmm. Now, I would like to comment on that mm-hmm. because people like to say that language changes. It is true, but language changes, but not entirely.
Of course.
Certain parts of the language change, journalese changes, mm-hmm. Spoken language changes, jargons, but they're deep and very deep layers of language that are remain the same for a very long time. They change, but they change very slowly. And therefore, we can now read Jane Austen, Thackeray, Dickens with some effort, but Jane Austen almost without an effort. And Jane Austen, what is the turn of 18th, 19th
century?
Sure,
it can sound very contemporary, but I'm just struck by the same thing here. It doesn't read as mannered or exactly antique. There's a freshness in this language that strikes me as very accessible today. We'll come back and talk about exactly that. We're delighted to have with us today the translator's new translation of Tolstoy's War and Peace. Richard Pevere is here and Larissa Volohonsky. You can join the conversation. Have you cracked what Henry James called this baggy monster? Did War and Peace transport you or defeat you? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. This is Tom Ashbrook with On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace in new translation and new relevance, maybe almost a century and a half after its first publication in Russia. I'm joined today by Richard Pevere and Larissa Volohonsky. They have come out with a brand new translation just in the bookstores as of yesterday. So this is fresh off the griddle, and it's a wonderful translation of this sweeping, call it what you will, panorama of the age of Napoleon at the gates of Moscow and so much swirling around that. You can join the conversation this hour. Have you been swept away by the passions, the humanity, the intimacy of War and Peace? Is this where you met Napoleon and the Russian winter, Count Bezukhov and Natasha Rostova? What can we learn from Tolstoy today about the chaos, the delusions, the arrogance of war? And maybe what about peace, the manners, the misalliances, the tender moments? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. In the 1956 film version of War and Peace, don't ask me who translated this one, a youthful Audrey Hepburn plays a love-struck Natasha Rostov. Here she speaks with her sister, Sonia, played by Mae Britt, about her new infatuation for Anatole Karagin, who comes between Natasha and her fiancé, Prince Andrei.
As soon as I saw him, I felt he was my master and I his slave, and I couldn't help loving him. Yes, his slave. Whatever he commands, I must do. What can I do, Sonia? What can I do?
If he loves you, why doesn't he come honestly to the house, to your father? Ask for your engagement to Andrei to be broken off. What's the reason for all this secrecy?
I don't know. It doesn't matter. Whatever his reasons, they are good ones. I told you I have no will. I love him.
Then I won't let it come to that. I shall tell.
Sonia, what do you mean? You wouldn't tell anyone. Don't torture me. I can't live without him.
Audrey Hepburn as the love-struck Natasha Rostov is not all battlefield there, or hunting, though it's plenty of that, but it's the parlor and the bedroom as well. Richard Pevere and Larissa Volohonsky are with us. Jennifer's calling from Charlestown, Massachusetts. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Charlestown, South Carolina.
Oh, sorry. Thank you very much.
That's okay.
Of course.
Many, many years ago, I studied Russian in Paris and saw the 12-hour Russian version of War and Peace. And it wasn't until last year that my husband and I took it on as a project, and every night for months he read War and Peace to me before we went to sleep. And
it was
incredible. And the Battle of Borodino, Prince Andrei and his musings before the battle, the capture of Bezukhov in the burning of Moscow. These are absolutely incredible scenes. I don't think there's anything that has ever been written about a battlefield as Tolstoy has written in the Battle of Borodino. And we were just captivated by one thing in particular, and this is a question I have for your translators whom
yes,
I
please.
Translate. It seemed to me that in many ways Kutuzov and Pierre, they have a sort of Zen Eastern approach to matters, and so my husband and myself have been wondering whether Tolstoy himself had been exposed to Eastern thought in terms of that the quality of letting things happen and of the kind of reflection, especially that Pierre has when he is a prisoner. Could you speak to that?
Of course we could, Jennifer, in Charleston, South Carolina. And what a wonderful image of your husband reading that to you night after night. And yes, it would be for months. And yes, I can only imagine how engrossing. It's a great picture. Richard Pevere, what about it? She asks about the great general who opposed Napoleon for Russia and the sort of main figure of this book, if we can describe it with such a huge cast, Pierre, Count Bezukhov. And their attitude toward life, toward perhaps war, she and her husband heard a Zen quality to it. What do you say to that?
Well, Tolstoy was interested in Buddhism and in Eastern thought. I don't know quite at what point and how much he studied it. He may also have come to it through the Russian peasant spirit, because the character of Platon Karatayev represents that quality of acceptance.
The Russian peasant who perseveres, accepts, and finds joy.
Finds joy, and if death comes, he finds death, but without struggle. But with Kutuzov, he also...
The great general.
The great general, the field marshal. Mm-hmm. For Tolstoy, he represented the mystical soul of Russia. Or rather, that he understood this of the Russian nation, of the Russian people. He was the leader of the national war. Once the war went to Europe, they got rid of Kutuzov. He didn't want to go to Europe. Mm-hmm. It didn't interest him. He had done what he was to do. And this is Kutuzov is shown as a very very much of a Christian, of a devout Christian.
He prays, he venerates the icon, he weeps before thanks God when he receives the news that Napoleon is abandoning Moscow. Mm-hmm. He is very deliberately portrayed as a devout Orthodox Christian.
And in this way held up in contrast to Napoleon himself.
Exactly. Napoleon is all will and self. He's a self-made man. He came from nowhere and became the ruler of half of Europe. But he couldn't defeat the spirit of the Russian people.
It strikes me that perhaps one thing Jennifer and her husband are picking up on are Tolstoy's notion of history itself. He was opposed to the sort of deliberate intentional view of history, maybe the history of great men. He saw it as chaos, confusion, happenstance, the unpredictable.
Exactly. That was one of the reasons he wrote the novel. He wanted to show the falsity of the notions of will, and that that in military or even in love, the intention leads to the fulfillment. Because, for instance, Natasha sees Pierre all through the novel. She keeps noticing him.
The lovely Natasha, the Count Pierre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But she likes him, and she feels good whenever she sees him, but she doesn't identify that feeling. She falls in love with André, but she also falls in love with Kuragin. And she was in love with Boris at the beginning.
Right, it's flying everywhere.
But Pierre always reappears and keeps reappearing, and finally, in this beautiful scene towards the end of the novel, they meet again and fall in love.
Would you read that scene for us? Or perhaps, Larissa, if you've got it, I think we pulled it out here. This is where he hasn't seen her for years.
Yes.
And they meet, but it's not immediately obvious to him who he's meeting.
He doesn't recognize her. And she's very quiet.
Here we are with our 1,200 pages. There's a copy. You can see on the lower left it begins. Mm-hmm. Would you mind reading that for us, Larissa Volohonsky?
Shall I give the context?
I
want to give
context,
a little
yes.
context. Yeah. The war is over. Pierre is saved from captivity. He recovers, and he comes to see Princess Maria Bolkonskaya at her house. Mm. And from the very beginning, he notices that Princess Maria is not alone. There is some woman dressed in dark with her, and he doesn't know who she is. Mm. Goes on talking with Princess Maria. Pierre was speaking quickly, animatedly. He glanced once at the face of the companion, saw an attentively tender, curious gaze directed at him, and, as often happens during a conversation, felt for some reason that this companion in the black dress was a sweet, kind, nice being who would not hinder his heart-to-heart talk with Princess Maria. But when he said the last words about the Rostovs, the perplexity on Princess Maria's face showed still more strongly. She again shifted her gaze from Pierre's face to the face of the lady in the black dress and said, "Don't you recognize her?" Pierre glanced once more at the pale, fine face of the companion with its dark eyes and strange mouth. Something dear, long forgotten, and more than sweet looked at him from those attentive eyes. "But no, it can't be," he thought. "This stern, thin, pale, aged face, it can't be her. It's only a reminiscence of that one." But just then Princess Maria said, "Natasha." And the face with its attentive eyes, with difficulty, with effort, like a rusty door opening, smiled. And from that open door, there suddenly breathed and poured out upon Pierre that long-forgotten happiness, of which especially now he was not even thinking. It breathed out, enveloped, and swallowed him whole. When she smiled, there could no longer be any doubt. It was Natasha, and he loved her.
Oh, and we're absolutely taken away. The rusty door opens, and it, as you translate it, it suddenly breathes and pours out upon Pierre. I mean, I don't know if, as a 13-year-old, you must have been swept away if you got that far. But at any age, who wouldn't be swept by that?
I weep each time I read it.
And choices made there, Richard Prevere, your choices as translators.
Well, the main thing in this, I think, in that last paragraph is the sequence of the words. And I think it's extremely important to follow that sequence very carefully, where he says, after Maria says Natasha, And the face with its attentive eyes, with difficulty, with effort, like a rusty door opening, and then a dash, smiled.
That rhythmic beating,
yes,
and then the pause.
Sustaining these three clauses, and then the final verb, smiled. And from that open door, there suddenly breathed and poured out upon Pierre that long-forgotten happiness of which especially now he was not even thinking. It breathed out, enveloped, and swallowed him whole. The rhythm of it is extremely important. And sometimes translators don't pay attention to that, thinking that they're translating a content rather than a work of art, which is always dependent on not only the information to be conveyed, but the way in which it's conveyed. So we this is what we try to do all the time in translating Tolstoy.
Yeah, and it's not our choice. It's rather, it's simply we're trying to be very close to the way Tolstoy did it. And these are the words that come to us.
And when you do that, somehow comes the sound, not stilted, again I say contemporary, or just fresh in human terms.
It is the freshness, yes, the immediacy. Yeah. There is this, it leaps at you.
And so knowing about humanity, human life.
Yes.
In this case, love, in War and Peace. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Zinovi calling from Alston, Massachusetts. Zinovi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Dobre utro, Tom. And your guests.
Доброе утро.
Здравствуйте.
I'm trying to disseminate the knowledge that when Tolstoy chose his title, he didn't mean peace, which is translated traditionally into English as peace. What he meant, there is an ancient Russian word "mir," which is even unfortunately, it's written in the same way as peace. What Tolstoy meant, it's war and society, or war and the town meeting, or war and the people. There is no notion of peace in the title.
Now, that's interesting. I have to say, war and the town meeting is not going to sell at the same clip as War and Peace. But let me get a response, Zinovi. Richard Pevere, what do you say?
Yes, I've heard several times this idea. The word and the other meaning of mir is very difficult to translate. It's a very essential cultural word for Russians. However, when Tolstoy referred to his novel in French, he called it Guerre et Paix, which in this case there is no ambiguity.
No ambiguity. Mm-hmm.
And he borrowed the title from what is his name? This Proudhon, Joseph Proudhon.
Mm-hmm.
Who wrote a book called Guerre et Paix.
Larissa, any second thoughts about the very title of the great work?
No. It's we thought about it, and we are familiar with what Zinovi is trying to disseminate, to make known. It's an interesting thought, but unfortunately, I think it is not correct. The all the scholars agree that it should be War and Peace.
But Zinovi, we thank you for the nuance and for your call there. Let's get Kristen from Johns Island, South Carolina. Kristen, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes, I would just like to say I am thrilled that they have translated War and Peace. I have read War and Peace once. It was a 1956 translation that was passed down from my mother, and I've read Anna Karenina four times.
In whose translation, Kristen?
I have the translation is it was published by Grosset and Dunlop. It was revised by Princess Alexandra Kropotkin.
Have you read Pavir and Volohonsky, my guest today? Have you read?
Well, I read their translation of Anna Karenina. Yes, and I was absolutely delighted and thrilled with their translation of Anna Karenina. And that is my favorite novel ever. And that's why I've read it four times over my lifetime. I was a Russian studies major, so I am thrilled, and I have, so I cannot wait to purchase their version of
War. So you've got the stamina, you've got the appetite to dive in again to the 1,000+ and be lost in Tolstoy.
Absolutely. Tolstoy is my favorite novelist, and if I had more time in my life, that's what I would do full time. I would be reading Tolstoy.
It's wonderful. Kristen, thank you very much for your call. Richard Pevere and Larissa Volohonsky, please stand by. We're talking about Tolstoy's War and Peace. You can join us where you have you been, swept away by the passions, the humanity, the intimacy here in War and Peace. 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Tolstoy's War and Peace in new translation and maybe new relevance almost a century and a half after its first publication in Russia. It's beautiful. It's grand. It is moving. It's serious. It's also been a subject for some fun. Woody Allen's 1975 comedy Love and Death is a giant spoof of War and Peace and Russian literature and thought. Here, Woody Allen, playing a frail young man named Boris, tries to wiggle out of having to fight the French. His friends and family, including his brother Ivan, are not pleased.
Have you heard the news? Napoleon has invaded Austria.
Why? Is he at a Courvoisier?
At last! A chance to taste the glories of battle!
Well, check with me when it's over. I'll be in the game room.
No, Boris. You're going to fight.
I'm going to fight? You're going to have your head examined.
We leave the day after tomorrow.
Fellas, I'm a pacifist. I don't believe in war.
Okay, we have some fun after 1,200 pages. We'll do that. Though there's fun here, too. Listeners, we would love to have you join us. We have Richard Pevere with us and Larissa Volohonsky, the husband and wife team, the A-team of Russian to English translation these days, says David Remnick of The New Yorker, with their brand new translation of War and Peace. You can join us. In what translation did you read War and Peace? The Maud, Constance Garnett's. Are you ready for the Pevere-Volohonsky rendition? And is this a story about Russia or all the world, about the USA today when it comes to war and peace? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Cammie's calling from New Orleans. Cammie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I've always considered myself an avid reader, but I came really late to War and Peace, I think partially because it was this huge monolith. I mean, it's a physically thick book.
Intimidating. Can drown you in the bathtub if you try and read there.
Completely intimidating. So I read it about 2 years ago, and I was really taken. It took me about 5 weeks to read, and once I started, I couldn't stop. And
yeah,
I now
found the same.
Yeah, I encourage everyone to read it now because I think the thing that surprised me was that it brought everything down. I mean, it's an all-encompassing story, and yet the scale is so human. And we have these individual characters and their individual responses when they're thrown into these life-rending situations. And
yeah,
it really addresses the human cost of war.
It does in such a detailed and voluminous way that just grips from beginning to end once you're in it. Cammie, thanks for that. Let me get another from Sherry in Portsmouth, Virginia. Sherry, you're on the air.
Greetings. I've been reminded of such warm memories growing up because I, too, read War and Peace when I was about 12, 13.
Ambitious black girl.
Yes, as a black Southern girl.
Wow.
In a place where the library had been segregated, and my mother marched us down as soon as it was integrated, and we would go every week, and I would read all of the classics by myself, and it was years later when I would understand the significance of what I mean, I knew what I was reading was incredible and wonderful, but it just introduced me to, it bridged me from the world, a segregated world, to a global world, and to this day, I still feel the effects of what that is. I think I'm a playwright, and I'm an activist in my community, and I think it's because of what I was exposed to, without anyone sort of, reading me, telling me their biases, and it's been wonderful, and I'm so excited about this translation, so I'm going to read it now and get what I didn't get when I was 12 years old.
That's so great, but I guess it's clear what you got was Tolstoy's generosity. He laid everything out there. Well, there were no walls or bars here, Sherry.
Absolutely. I was able to put that world beside my world, a world that had been segregated that was now integrated, and then going into the, you know, the 60s and in the 70s, you know, I went to Penn, University of Pennsylvania, and I realized, you know, there was a world out there that I had been exposed to in books by Tolstoy and Austin, that if I'd never read those, I would have never known those things. I would have never had any clue of it. So
you found such a great
expansion of, you know, of my worldview, and yeah. I'm just so excited to hear about this translation. So I want my daughter to be able to experience that, but of course she won't be able to do it in quite the same kind of a bohemian, you know, barefoot way that I did. But I think still it is a wonderful, wonderful way for children of today to be able to understand the world, you know, out there, and we need to desperately.
Good for your barefoot courage and the bridge you find, the door. Talk about a big door swinging open. Wow, Larissa, Richard, think of it.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's amazing. It's an amazing book, you know. It was called once, I don't remember by whom, Encyclopedia of Russian Life, but also of universal life. It appeals to everybody. There is everything in it. Friendship, courtship, betrayal, there are duels, there's secondary heroes are fascinating. Dolokhov, who comes to Pierre, he betrayed Pierre with his wife.
Yes.
And then he goes
very literally
to Pierre.
Pierre shot him.
they fought a duel, and then Pierre... Dolokhov comes up to him on the field of Austerlitz, of Borodino. Borodino, and says, and ask forgiveness. He said, "We may all perish in this battle. Forgive me." It's so.
And Pierre doesn't expect that. He's very struck, and he's in fact speechless. He doesn't know what to say.
Pierre
but
says
the spiritual seeker, he somehow takes it on board.
Yeah, he takes it on board, but he wasn't up to that.
Yeah.
And it astonished him that Dolokhov, this
madcap
duelist and drinker,
who cuckolded him, Pierre,
cuckolded him, should come up to him, should reveal this side of himself.
All of that splendor and intimacy, and yet, you know, there was Henry James saying this is a loose and baggy monster. I mean, it's been praised by many, but it's also confused some and put some off. What's that history about, Richard?
That's a very interesting question. It goes back to some things we were beginning to talk about earlier. It brings them together. The question of the form of War and Peace, because very often it's said that it succeeds despite its formlessness. And I'm very opposed to that notion, because a work of art always has to succeed through its form.
Mm-hmm.
And if it has no form, it's not a work of art. It's not finished. What we need to understand is what form Tolstoy was trying to achieve, and how it works. And he, as I said earlier, he himself couldn't define it. He could only do it. He could show it by doing it, and then he created a new form. And there is this sense, but it's not so specifically worked out as Henry James would have liked.
Mm-hmm.
Henry James was much more of an aesthete. Tolstoy was not and was never an aesthete. He made fun of aesthetes. He called them hairdressers.
Don't be so prim. Say it again until you get it across.
But he was concerned with the form of what he was saying. He was extremely concerned with it. This was the most original part of his writing. It was this, and there is the sense of, as you mentioned, of overall unity. There is some overarching harmony and unity, and this may be also this Zen feeling, because there's a unity that can't be put into words. It can only be shown. It can only be sensed.
Just walk through the panorama with him and take it on board.
But it's not a chaos. For some reason, even though there's no imposed order, there's not chaos in the book.
Let's go to Scott in Acton, Massachusetts. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. A few years ago, Condoleezza Rice was interviewed in the New Yorker magazine, and she said War and Peace was her favorite book. And she said she read In the Russian Twice. And I'm curious...
Of course, she was a Russian scholar.
And she was a Russian scholar.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea of Zen and sort of a completion, and you can't really define it, when asked by the reporter, how could that be that she appreciated War and Peace so much, given it's sort of a wave theory of history as opposed to particle, great man particles, which sort of undermines some of the rhetoric coming from her administration. I'll try to keep the politics
which out Tolstoy of it. Rejects.
Yes, yes. She said, well, she just skipped those parts.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering, listening to the poetry discussion, you finally convinced me after 5 years it could be that she skipped it just for the poetry, but should it be?
That she read it just for the poetry.
Yeah, what would you be left with?
Scott, stick with us for a second. I mean, this gets into something very interesting here. David Brooks wrote about it over the summer. George Bush as an exemplar, we can see it in his policies, of the notion that one man can change the world, order American troops into Iraq. The idea was to change the Middle East. Tolstoy, more the wave theory, Scott says, but it's not, you know, nobody can direct it. There's more chaos and confusion than that. So how do you imagine then, Richard Prevere, Condoleezza Rice, now handmaiden to George Bush, reading this, not wanting to accept the Tolstoy view, but still, it's her favorite book.
Well, a lot of people say that. A lot of people read it that way. It's very often said if you read it without all of these digressions, the author's digressions about history and about great men, or their lack of greatness, rather. You don't miss anything. Even Nabokov, who was himself an extremely conscientious artist, formalist, said this. He said about all the ideas of Levin in Anna Karenina that he told his students, just don't read them. And as if there was no loss. In translating the book, I realized the function, the importance of these passages, these very passages that people find either annoying or interruptions of the action.
Do you mean the sort of polemicist Tolstoy, the essayist who lectures you?
Yes, the essayist who lectures on Napoleon, who lectures on the lack of freedom, or the illusory idea of great men acting out on their own will and imposing their will on the world. This stylistically, poetically, in other words, is very important. It's part of the composition, and we see these very intimate things that you were mentioning and that are so moving in the novel. We see them because they're set against this other voice, this historically polemical, angry, and didactic voice.
Scott, how do you read our Secretary of State, who says she loves that the poetry of it, the intimacy of it, but no thanks, perhaps, to the notion of history in it?
This has been such a beautiful discussion about the poetry. I'll try not to impose my political views, but it seems incomplete. It is interesting that there seems to be a whole school that does read it for the poetry. I was wondering if the language of the you know, huge tracts of historical worldview, is that in the same sort of poetic vein as the rest of the book, or is it written in a different style?
Yes, it's quite a different style. That's what I mean about the composition of the book. It's one of the voices in a whole series, a whole rich range of voices. One of them is the rationalist Tolstoy who wants to prove that no one knows what they're doing, which is an interesting thing to prove, and that the sources of action and the goals of action are unknowable. This is his thinking, but I think poetically it's important. I must say that after translating it word by word, I almost got convinced that he's right. You know?
But maybe Condoleezza Rice's George Bush is the counterpoint, the counterproof. I mean, would the United States have gone to war in Iraq if George W. Bush were not president? Would France have gone to the gates of Moscow without Napoleon Bonaparte? We don't have to settle the politics today, but let the question hover. If we've got 3 minutes. Sam's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I read the book while hitchhiking in Nova Scotia. Whenever I think of War and Peace, I think of The Trail. And one thing about the poem is it's written in such wonderful short chapters that it's an ideal travel book. It's an awesome book, but it's also But I wanted to ask you, I always thought of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, and I love your Dostoevsky translations, as almost the Mozart and Beethoven of Russian literature. That Dostoevsky almost has this kind of almost godly overview that Mozart has, and Dostoevsky's kind of really in the trenches with the blood and the toil of humanity. I was wondering if you would talk about the two of them, since you know them so well.
You're pointing at each other. I don't know.
Well.
I have to say first, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Richard, Larissa, do we have Dostoevsky and Tolstoy as the Mozart and Beethoven, or vice versa, of Russian literature?
I don't know about the musical analogy. It is probably something can be made with it, but they certainly are two very different writers. But I think Richard will speak better about it.
Well, the trouble is, I would see Mozart in Dostoevsky. So it's
yes, I would as well. I think perhaps that's what our caller was saying.
But and Tolstoy's favorite composer, although he hated music, he said, was Beethoven. But the two of them are very different. The narrative of Dostoevsky is mostly drama. His action is usually restricted to a few days, maybe even one day, 2 days.
Mm.
Confrontations all the time, people thrown together, arguing, and changing each other through their words. Tolstoy has this flow of time and development. Things move through time, surprising things come out of time. And there is no real beginning, there is no real end. It simply extends through time. So they are very different in that way.
And beautiful moments, here's one from your translation with Larissa. Having cleared the road, Denisov stopped at the entrance to the bridge, casually holding back his stallion, who was straining toward his fellows and stamping his foot. He looked at the squadron that was moving toward him. The transparent sounds of hooves rang out on the planks of the bridge as if several horses were galloping, and the squadron, with officers in front, four men abreast, stretched across the bridge and began to come out on the other side, and page after page, and it's wonderful from front to back, and we're so grateful for your work and for sharing some of it with us today. It's a big one. We can only dip into it, but my goodness, what a pleasure. Richard Prevere and Larissa Volohonsky, translators, the latest in a long line of Tolstoy's War and Peace. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having us.
Wonderful to have you as well. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.